All right, as we pick up the study that we finished up with last week, we got to about verse 3. And as you look at verse 3, you see that he first says the falling away will come first, and then the man of sin is going to be revealed. Now, it doesn't say he's going to arise. He's already there. He's already part of this falling away, but he can't be revealed or uncovered until something occurs. So as you continue looking, he says in verse, let's see, where is it? Yeah, verse 4, he opposes, we're still in verse 3. The man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself against all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. Now, I want to start with this concept of the mystery of lawlessness. Let's just start in Matthew chapter 7. Jesus says, not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do what? Do the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, did we not cast out demons? Did we not do many mighty works? And then I will profess to them, I never knew you. Depart from me who? You who practice lawlessness. So the mystery of lawlessness, was it already at work even in Jesus' days? Yeah, because what's happening is revealed. Look at the book of Galatians. Look at Acts chapter 15. Was there a mystery of lawlessness working when the Jews said you must keep the law and command the Gentiles to be circumcised? Did these Judaizing teachers continually cause trouble in the church, and Paul having to write the Galatian letter and tell them you're severed from Christ and you fall from grace if you are circumcised? You're a debtor to keep the whole law. So the Judaizing teachers, for the first, maybe 10 years of the church, it was the Judaizing teachers that were the big mystery of lawlessness. And that doesn't really stop. Do we still have Seventh-day Adventists today? Do we still have people today who are teaching parts of the old law? Even Roman Catholicism, they have a priesthood, they have an altar, they have many things that they brought forward because this mystery of lawlessness was already working. Now, 1 Corinthians, he introduces another aspect of this mystery of lawlessness, and that is the wisdom of men. Remember how he talks about the wisdom of man? Behold your calling, not many wise, not many noble, not many mighty are called, because God has chosen the foolish things. So the wisdom of human philosophy was being brought into the church, and what's the name that we characterize that as? Anybody remember? It's a Greek word for no. Didn't help? Okay.
Gnosticism.
Yeah, Gnosticism. Oh. Exactly. Because the Greek word for no is gnosis. So, Gnosticism. Now, Gnosticism is responsible for babies born in sin. That didn't come from the scriptures. That came right out of Gnosticism, and lots of it did. So, the mystery of lawlessness, the Judaizing teachers, and the Gnostic teachings were already infiltrating and causing the church to be on the verge of apostasy. Remember what Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4? They will, with itching ears, what are they going to do? They're going to heap up teachers, and they're going to, what are they going to do to their ears? Going to scratch and tickle their ears. And they're going to turn away from the truth to what? To fables. Fables. Like Mary is the mother of God, and we should worship maybe. Mary, sorry, not maybe. We have relics. Relics came up very quickly after the teachings of the, or after the death of the apostles. So the idea of a relic, that you have a piece of the cross, or that you have a piece of the robe, and that relic will help you. And, of course, the sign of the cross. All of these things are permeating, and they're already starting. And when he goes to the elders at Ephesus, what does he tell them in Acts chapter 20, verses 28-31? Men from among your own selves will arise, drawing away the disciples after themselves. So the iniquity of lawlessness is already working. Paul's already able to tell these people this. So what I wanted to do in the first part of the class, I'm going to skip this first verse because I think we've pretty well covered it. So I don't think we need to do that one. Although there is a couple of points in here that I think are important. And that is verse 3, forbidding to marry. How quickly did that come into the Catholic Church? How quickly were they no longer allowed to marry? How quickly was it that the bishops, who in 1 Timothy chapter 3 must have a wife, how quickly did that arise? See, it was pretty quick. It was very quick before these things occurred. Maybe in the first 100, 200 years. It wasn't that quick, but it still occurred very quickly. Commanding to abstain from foods, that was already in a place when Paul wrote the Colossian letter. Handle not, nor touch, nor taste, all of which have a wisdom in a human wisdom, however, they have no value in the indulgences of the flesh. So this is all going on, and it's going to start with these elders. Verse 29, after my departure. Now, this verse has always caused me, you remember he says, that which restrains until it's taken out of the way. Most people say this is either the living apostles or the Roman government, because both of those were holding down the mystery of lawlessness. As long as Paul was alive, every time a church got out of line, what happened?
Correct him.
He sent a letter. How far could the people carry the church while Paul was alive? And while Peter was alive? While John, I mean, look at John, 1 John. How many times does he say, there's many antichrists, watch out for them, they were of us, now they're not of us. And we are of God, he who hears us knows God, he who does not hear us does not know God. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. So this mystery of lawlessness and this idea that there's something restraining until it be taken out of the way. Now, the death of the apostles took it to a certain point. But until Rome fell, could the Pope take the power that he ultimately received? Life and death power over everyone? See, Rome wouldn't have let that happen. So that's another restraining influence. All right, so I'm going to skip all of that. This is what the organization of the church is supposed to look like. Jesus Christ, the chief shepherd, and the bishops and the shepherds are one and the same. I just put them like that. I put it like that because in the next slide, we're going to bump it up. But here, is there any difference between bishops and shepherds? Does the church have bishops over them? Yeah. Does it have elders over them? Yeah. So Jesus Christ, the chief shepherd, and elders and bishops over the church. This is how the Lord's church is supposed to look like. Now, all the information that we have about the falling away comes from history books. Now, how reliable are history books? See, it's very dangerous, isn't it, to make our conclusions regarding the fulfillment of this prophecy just by the writings of human authors. And I just want to say that going in, because I think we can pretty well prove this even without all of that. But I think it's important for us to see exactly what happened. So there's several history books, and you've heard of most of them, I'm sure. The Rise or the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. This is 6 volumes by Edward Gibbon. Then we have the Early Church Fathers, which are the writings of all of the Christians from 100 to 425, and it's about that long. I mean, you can look and you can read for yourself when this writer says, this is what we do in the church, and this is what we do in the church. And I think that's pretty reliable. I think that we can look at that and get a pretty fair picture. So I'll skip this because it doesn't really matter. Then we have the History of the Christian Church by Schaff, and this is an 8-volume set, and it's about that wide, and it's really enjoyable to read. I think that most of you here would. He's a very easily readable author. So let's talk about this just for a second, because we've already touched on it. But this is basically what happened. After the death of the apostles, this whole new group came in, and they were converted out of the world. And it's just like today, when we convert a scientist out of the world who believes in evolution, what's his tendency to do with Genesis chapter 1? Okay, he wants to bring the two together. So now, instead of 24-hour periods, what happens to the days?
No way.
They become ages. Ages of billions of years or millions of years. And that's Gnosticism. When the culture wants to read into the Bible what's going on in the culture in order to fit in, that's what Gnosticism is. So today, if this happens, and it looks like it is, if homosexuality is actually brought into the Christian religion as an acceptable lifestyle, what will have to happen to the scriptures? We'll have to reinterpret them, right? We'll have to reinterpret them. And is that happening already? And there's another form of Gnosticism. So we see it in science. We see it in morality. How about marriage, divorce, remarriage? Has that changed many people's views on what Jesus said? Yeah, well, that's Gnosticism. That's taking the human philosophies of an age, blending them with the scriptures, and coming up with an alternate doctrine that is perfectly suited to the culture that people want to live in. So they want to be Christians. They just don't want to pay the price to be a Christian. And that's what makes these apostate religions so... So anyway, we'll pass on that. And let's just read. Now, most of these are quotes out of this history book, because this guy knows a whole lot more than I do. So I'm just going to read him. With the beginning of the second century. Now, keep in mind, what century is this? It's the 21st, but what is it really? I mean, do you write 21, 22 on your check? Why do we put 2020 on our check when it's the 21st century? Well, because the first century was zero, right? The second century is 100 to 200. It gets kind of confusing, but I just want to make that clear, that when you're reading about things that happened in the 19th century, you're actually reading things that started in 1801 and continue on until 1900. So with the beginning of the second century, which is early, about 120. Now, when did John write John, we think?
Late 90s.
So 120, 15, 20, 25 years. With the beginning of the second century, from Ignatius. Now, Ignatius is one of these fathers who wrote a lot of stuff. All right. The two terms are distinguished and designate two offices. The bishop being regarded first as the head of a congregation surrounded by a council of presbyters. Now, the Greek word presbyter means what? You know, because we use it all the time. The elders. Okay, presbyteros means an old man or an elder. So the and we'll also be reading the word episcopate. Now, episcopos is the bishop. So episcopate means the office of those who are overseeing the elders and the presbyters, which Presbyterian Church comes from, that's the elders. All right, afterwards, as the head of a diocese and successor of the apostles. All right, so very early in the second century, very early in the hundreds, the iniquity of lawlessness is already working. And so what happens is that immediately upon the death of the apostles, because this elder met John, or this elder had hands laid on him by Paul, and this elder became the bishop. And there was a reason. If you were smarter, if you were better, if you had these connections, then you became the bishop that everybody came to. And ultimately, that became a hierarchy. All right? So now, well, let's skip that. You know what I did? I did it the wrong way. That's what happened. This was what was supposed to be that first slide. So let's go back and look at that again. This is what happened. We have one bishop over the shepherds. One bishop over the shepherds. One bishop over the shepherds. It started in Ephesus, and then it continued throughout the Roman Empire. So, whoops, let's go back to this one. Yeah, let's go back to this one. the bishops initially were equal because they were successors of the apostles. But they gradually fell into different ranks based on the ecclesiastical. Now, ecclesia is what? The church. So, you know, they use these big words. Really, but gradually they fell into ranks based on the church or the political importance of their districts. So Jerusalem was not a politically important district, but what was it? Jerusalem was very important as far as the history of the church is concerned. Antioch in Syria was not politically important, but it was the base of operations for the Apostle Paul. Alexandria, Egypt, on the other hand, it had political importance. It became one of these centers. So did Rome, so did Ephesus, and ultimately so did Constantinople, where the Emperor Constantine moved it over. So, on the lowest level stood the bishops of country churches, who stood between the presbyters and the city bishops. In the villages of large dioceses in Asia Minor and Syria and also in Gaul. All right, so this is permeating. This is between 100 and 250. So in the first 150 years after the death of the apostles, we see the church gradually shifting from elders over every church, all of them equal, all of them servants, to a bishop over each church, and the bishops in the countries were lesser than the bishops in the cities. But depending on the importance of your city, that's what ultimately led to these archbishops. So that's what's going to come next. So we look at that, and so now we have the shepherds at the bottom. Then we have the bishops over country churches, over lower class churches. Then we have the archbishops who are now going to be in cities like Jerusalem and cities like Antioch and cities like Ephesus or in cities where Rome, important places. All right, still older and more important is the distinction of the apostolic mother churches, such as those at Jerusalem, Antioch, Ephesus, Alexandria, Corinth, and Rome. So these bishops took special prominence. And about this time, Rome's starting to totter. And these bishops are starting to gain not just church power, ecclesiastical power, but also political power. So they, because they were capitals, respectively, of the three divisions of the Roman Empire. So Antioch, Rome, and Alexandria. Alexandria in Egypt, Rome, of course, in Italy, and Antioch at the top of just above Jerusalem. So these were the political districts, centers of trade, intercourse, combining with their apostolic origin the greatest, now notice this, political weight. Okay, we're moving from church into politics now. And this is very slow. But when Constantine came along, he basically said, only those who are in the church are going to be officials in the Roman Empire. And so all of a sudden, everybody wants to be a bishop. All these politicians. Can you imagine what would happen if all of these elected officials were told that you can only continue as an elected official if you become a member of the Church of Christ? And so next week we've got all these politicians in here vying. And what's going to happen to the church? We're going to be outvoted. Except we're going to have to be careful about letting them place membership. We're going to have to really... Anyway, to the Bishop of Antioch, all Syria and his metropolitan district, to the Bishop of Alexandria, all Egypt, to the Bishop of Rome, central and lower Italy. Now, this is bringing us into the 250 to 350 range. So within 300 years, 250, actually 250 years, the iniquity of lawlessness had already produced basically the entire architecture of the Roman Catholic Church, with the exception, of course, of the Pope. And he will come just not long after this. So, to the spiritual preeminence of the bishops was now added, from the time of Constantine, a civil importance. Through the union of church and state, the bishops became at the same time state officials. So they became the Pontius Pilates. They became the Herods. They became the proconsul. And they had not just power in the church, because they were bishops over the churches. So, let's keep reading there. Through the union of the church with the state, the bishops became at the same time state officials of weight and enjoyed the various privileges which accrued to the church from this connection. They had, therefore, an independent and legally valid jurisdiction. So now what had been mandated just by their false teaching is now mandated by the nation of Rome. And now their power over all the churches is based not only on their false doctrines, but also on Constantine, who made that happen. So they had, therefore, independent and legally valid jurisdiction. They held supervision of the church estates. They had partial charge, even over church city property. They superintended the morals of the people with jail and death sentences and punishments based on their decisions. So they superintended the morals of the people and even of the emperor. And they exerted influence upon the public legislature. So these people are now in positions of power that is absolute. Life and death. Prison. If you're charged with being a heretic, you could end up being put to death. All right. Now we're in the 350 to 450 range. So this iniquity has continued. Now keep in mind, brethren, I'm not saying that that's the falling away Paul's talking about. We'll have to prove that later. I'm just saying this is historical fact. This is what happened to the church. All right, let's keep reading. Among the city bishops towered the bishops of the capitals, cities of the various provinces. They were styled in the east metropolitans, in the west archbishops. They had the oversight of the other bishops of the province, or ordained them in connection with two or three assistants. So now, these bishops in Rome and Alexandria, they're appointing the guys under them to be the bishops. And so they're getting their allies. And of course, you probably remember that during the Middle Ages, these cardinals were at the courts in Spain, in England, in France, in all of these areas, making sure the Pope's will is being observed. And they actually had more power than the king. Still above the metropolitans stood the five patriarchs. Now, what's the Greek word patriarch mean?
Father.
All right, so what's already in the church? Call no man father on the earth. What are they doing? They're calling these guys fathers. That's why the Pope is the universal father, because what does Papa mean in Latin? Father. Okay, so above the metropolitan stood the five patriarchs. The oligarchical, I don't know why they have to use these kind of words, so to speak, the five towers in the edifice of the Catholic hierarchy of the Greek Roman Empire. So
that
now they've
that,
got...
That is an interesting term, oligarchical. I mean, you're talking about corruption there. I mean, that's where you're, you know, that's a perfect word.
Okay, yeah, because I don't even know what that word means. I was going to tell you what it means, but I don't know what it means. Anybody know what it means?
It's like a corrupt leadership.
It must be Latin, because I don't see anything Greek. Well, archos means a ruler. So, but I don't know what oligarch, anyway, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. All right, these patriarchs, in the official sense of the word, as already fixed at the time of the Fourth Ecumenical Council, were the bishops of the four great capitals of the empire: Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, and Constantinople, to whom was added, by way of honorary distinction, the bishop of Jerusalem. So he was just kind of an appendage that they gave the honor to, but he really didn't have anything he could say. So Rome, Alexandria, Egypt, Antioch, Syria, and Constantinople, which is where Constantine moved the capital from Rome to Constantinople during his reign. Thus, at the close of the 4th century, at the close of the 300s, we see the Catholic Church of the Greco-Roman Empire under the oligarch of 5 coordinate and independent patriarchs, 4 in the east, 1 in the west. All right, so here they are. Here's the Roman Empire, and here's Rome, here's Ephesus, here's Antioch. Where's Constantinople's here. I don't know why I don't have one there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. So Alexandria, Egypt, Jerusalem, Antioch. That must be Constantinople there, because that's Byzantine or Istanbul was Constantinople. This is just map of a current map that I found. So that's where they were. You can see they're strategically placed throughout the Roman Empire. At last, the Roman bishop, on the ground of his divine institution as a successor of Peter, where he got that, like I said, this is all Gnosticism. This is all human blending of wisdom, tradition with the church, advanced his claim to be primate. Now, that doesn't mean a monkey, right? The primates. That means somebody who's prime. That's somebody who's at the top. He's the primate of the entire church and the visible representative of Christ, who is the invisible supreme head of the Christian world. This is the strict and exclusive sense of the title Pope. So now we have the Roman Catholic hierarchy. And then, of course, for nearly 1,000 years, the Pope was unchallenged. We call it the Dark Ages, 1,000-year Dark Ages. It was not until Martin Luther, Calvin, Knox, King Henry VIII, they challenged the authority of the Pope, started the Reformation movement, which, by the way, the Catholic Church says that's the falling away. They say these guys are the men of sin. And so they've got their own way to interpret this. So here's basically the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. There's Catholics, which are the laity. There's the priests, the bishops, the archbishops, the cardinals, and the Pope. And so basically looking like that. So here's what the church looks like under Roman Catholic reign. They have a Pope. You probably can't read all these. They have cardinals, archbishops, bishops, priests, abbots, monks, friars, canons, third orders, abbesses, nuns, and third orders. Now, how many of those you find in the scriptures?
None.
Yeah, none. All right. So I think that without a doubt we can say that the Catholic Church is the embodiment of a falling away, and that the Pope very clearly fits this man of sin who was revealed. See, he was already there. That's the point of Paul's statement there. The falling away comes, the man of sin is already there, but he's not revealed until something restraining, which again was the apostles and the Roman government. And so that's what I wanted to talk about before we started. I just wanted to get us all on the same page of what happened. Now, we've skipped over a ton of things because, as I say, the infant baptism and the worship of Mary and the relics and the monks and the friars and the flagellation and the beds of nails. I mean, there was so much going on in those first few centuries that just make you sick. All right, I'm going to come down here now. Oops, I better take this with me. So, before I start this paper, does anybody have any comments or anything they'd like to add to what we just said? This is just pure history. As I say, it's not out of the Bible, so it's probably not perfect. But this guy's just charting. what these people said happened, what they wrote about, and how he could glean from all of those writings all of this information. Like I said, I'm really glad he did it, because I wouldn't want to have to read this many things. He read them all and then condensed it into 8 volumes. And then Shepherd, member of the Church of Christ in the late 1800s, he took Shaft's material and boiled it down into a book called The Church, the Fallen Way, and the Restoration. And it's really interesting. Go ahead, George.
Are you thinking that we should say one falling away, or actually multiple falling aways, when you consider all that you showed us there this morning, which kind of actually wind up with the Catholic Church today, I suppose you would say, but there's so many different things in there. And,
exactly. That's why I say you can't. You really struggle with the absolute fulfillment. I mean, it partially covers it, but then the Protestant Reformation, although I don't know where you'd throw the man of sin in that one, but most people today are waiting for this to come. So, yeah, you're right. That's the problem, is you can't make it fit so perfectly that people can't say, wait a minute, that doesn't really fit exactly what you're saying. The only thing that I think is helpful in all this is that the Lord's appearing is going to destroy this man of sin. So if, and he said the iniquity of lawlessness is already working. So we can't really stretch the iniquity of lawlessness already working to beyond us, you think? Can we do that? Can we say the iniquity of lawlessness that was working has just been under the scenes, and we're still waiting for the man of sin, and we're still waiting for the falling away and the man of sin to be revealed? But you're right, George. I mean, that's why I've been hedging this all the way along, because I would like to say, and I used to do this. I mean, when I was in my 20s and knew everything, I would tell everybody, this is definitely what it is. But now I try to be a little more cautious. I'm pretty sure. I mean, it fits everything. Not perfectly, but pretty closely. Go ahead, Virgil.
Would it be safe to say that what happened in the first 150, 200 years is a pattern of a falling away of a mystery? Because when you look at it and exactly what happened, it wouldn't be far-fetched to take and say, what's wrong with it? And they see what has happened.
Wow.
And in a sense, and I'm not trying to use that as a derogatory term, it's just when I take and read some of the history that took place after there, and especially with the turn of Alexander Campbell, Barton Stone, and all of those people, there was fallacies that these people was teaching at that time that led into the falling away that we had over the institutional question, over the music question, all of that. And astute followers of the scriptures could see that, but they were branded as being, you call them far out right wingers or whatever, you know, that you couldn't take and trust them because it was too far out. But really what has turned around is exactly what happened. And we see it happening again.
Right. Well, that which has been is
that
which shall be. So it's a continual cycle. Nothing's really different today. It's just that we have somewhere in the point of history the man of sin. And that direct article is important there, because he's making it very clear there's just one specific individual. And that's why I say the Pope would really fit that, because although the office has changed hands, he's still the same guy. Charles and then George.
Yeah, also along the same lines, too. When we're talking about the falling away, I know that we are responsible for the tract about the one true church and those that fell away from the Catholic in 606 A.D. and how
all of these other denominations came into existence, but it all started back during that time.
Right.
So it was the falling away, and somebody came along and said, okay, well, we want to name it something else, and somebody started this denomination, and somebody else started that denomination, and it fell away from the original, from the Catholic Church. Or something.
Yeah, no, and that's right, and that's why Jesus and Paul and Peter, they just kept hammering, you can't add to, you can't take from, you have to do my Father's will. If you abide in my word, you're my disciples. And if you look at the church in 150 AD and you compare it to the one that is in the scriptures, you can't even recognize it. There has been so much of a falling away. George, you had another comment?
Well, there's so many things that actually several that you didn't even mention, and that's Mohammed and Mohammedism and what they call them, the wars that resulted, where the Catholic Church was fighting the Muslims or
the Crusades.
Unto that. And all of these things represent falling away from God in one way or another.
Yeah.
So I think the lesson for us is that we need to watch out that we don't get led into another falling away, if you will.
Yeah. And we don't have to figure any of this out because it's given, the purpose of this information is not to give us this falling away. I made this point several times at the beginning. Why is this in here? Got nothing to do with falling away. But the falling away has to come before what? The second coming. This whole chapter is dealing with the second coming. Now, the falling away is just an ancillary part of it, and that's why I say we don't get a lot of details. I was thinking yesterday when it said, don't you remember when I was with you, I told these things, and I'm thinking, man, I wish he'd told us these things, but he didn't. So they had information we don't have, and that tells me something. God doesn't want us to have it, so he didn't give it to us. If he'd wanted us to have it, he would have given it to us. Patrick, you got a comment?
Chapter 40 and read verse 30 and see what Paul said in the book. He said, even for your own number, men will arise and deserve the truth in order to what? To draw and will disciple after themselves and break away. You see, this is a breakaway because according to Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, chapter 1, verse 3.
Chapter 2. Right.
Verse 3. He said, don't let anyone deceive you in any way. This is what the breakaway. This is why we read the book of Acts chapter 20, verse 30. Because this is why people come into the church. To draw disciples after themselves that break away because they vet the truth. This is why when people say Catholic Church was the first church ever established is false. Jesus never established the Catholic Church, he established the church,
right,
which is the Church of Christ. And how people went into the church and draw disciples, you see, from the church. So if you look at it very carefully, in line with what our Lord Savior Jesus Christ said in the book of Matthew, chapter 24. See what he said in Matthew chapter 24, verse 24. He said, for false Christ and false prophet will appear and what? Perform great signs and miracles. Always in our world today. That draw people away from the truth. Because people follow signs and miracles instead of So we have to be very careful. Because we have to read the scripture as our main one.
Right. And unfortunately, just like Daniel, when he finished Daniel, he said, seal up the book, because I'm not going to give you enough information, and you're not going to know this is going to happen in the future. And that's our problem. If we'd lived in the 300s, what would we be saying? The falling away is definitely the Catholic Church, but the man of sin hadn't come yet. And then if we were in 600, if we were in 800, if we were in 1,000, if we were in 1,500. And it's interesting because you read these books and these commentaries on Revelation, they always start with their time frame and then they interpret it. And of course, 100 years later, what's happened to that? It's worthless, right? I mean, it's something to laugh at when you read about how Napoleon Bonaparte was, or how Muhammad was, or how this or that was. And so, anyway, that's what I tell people today. You know, if you're going to try to use current history to make your interpretations in 100 years, oh, there won't be it. We won't be here in 100 years. Well, yeah, we probably will. That's what everybody else said. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, there's lots of moving parts here that we have to consider. One, the way is very, very narrow, for sure. Two, God is very long-suffering, and he's wanting all to come to repentance. And I have to conclude that throughout history, regardless of just what happened to the church, there's always been a righteous remnant of Christians who obeyed the Bible, because we're still here. We're still, as a testimony. I don't know if there's any history that backs that up, but, I'm kind of reaching a logical conclusion that, there's still people in this world that are going to repent. There's people out here that are still that are in seeking of being saved. And, I don't, there's just so much in here because we're still here. We're still dealing with the same. I mean, it's just huge what's going on as far as false teachers go in this world. There's just so much false teaching going on. It's really hard for the truth to get out, but it's still getting out.
No, that's right. Yeah. David had a real interesting book. This guy was a liberal preacher, but he went in, he was a scholar, so they let him go in, and he went through all of the history, all of the books in the libraries in England, and he found where churches that sounded just like the Church of Christ that were persecuted. There was one here and one here and one here and one here. And of course, we can't pass judgment whether they were or not, but they were trying to be. And so I think that when Jesus said the gates of Hades will not prevail against it, I don't think there was ever a time in history of the world where the church wasn't here in one form or another. Because where two or three are gathered in my name, so all you'd have to have is three guys who are trying to do. Now, they may not have gotten near as far as we did, but if they were trying to get back to that, well, then we just have to leave that into the hands of the Lord. But I know one thing, at least they're trying. Yeah, so that's going to be, when you're trying, I don't know that it matters as much how far you get, because it depends on where you start. Campbell and some of those other guys, as Virgil pointed out, they didn't leave it all. They had too much in their heads. So they got us to a certain point, then they pulled back. And what happened to all those people they taught all those years? We'll leave that to the Lord. But we consider that the restoration movement, even though we see things that are going on back there that we would say to ourselves, well, those really aren't quite the way that we would understand that they should have been. So anyway, like I said, I'm glad the Lord's judging, because we can't judge the secrets of men's hearts. We can only see what they're doing. And sometimes what they're doing looks like the right thing, but if you'd see in your hearts, then you would know it wasn't. And sometimes what they're doing doesn't look quite right because they don't have the knowledge yet. But in their heart, because I look back at my own life, I'm sure you can too. We've all held positions at some point in our life that we had to repudiate because we realized that this isn't right. All right, well anyway, let's go ahead and stop there. And I guess we'll pick up with this paper next week. Because I want to go through the details and then see if we can fit what happened into what Paul says is going to happen. And I think we can fit a lot of it, but like George pointed out, and like I think we're all aware of, there's been a lot of time since that would fit it too. So it's really, really difficult. Although I think from their perspective, we need to look at it from the first time after they, not the first time that we can look at, because we're almost 2,000 years down the road. All right, thanks everybody. We'll stop there.